Cambridge 105 Radio. Women Making Waves on Cambridge 105 Radio. We have put together a programme which celebrates women. We find women who are striking out on their own and achieving some extraordinary results.
I'm Linda Ness.
And I'm Susie Thorpe.
And we produce and present Women Making Waves. In this edition of Women Making Waves, we meet Kath Austin, founder of successful UK company BB Wraps, who tells us how she grew the business from her own need to find a way of keeping food fresh that didn't include plastic.
And Patrice Lawrence, award-winning writer whose books reflect the diverse range of lives and experiences she sees every day.
That's all coming up on this episode of Women Making Waves.
Just after Kath Austin had a child, she became troubled about using throwaway plastic. She wondered how people had stored food in the past and found that soaking cloth in beeswax had been popular. After much experimentation, she devised her own method of making wraps and now runs the very successful BB Wraps. Kath tells Linda Ness her story.
A great idea is a great idea, and it will always be a great idea unless it becomes a great action. So don't just have a great idea and then say, oh yeah, I wish I'd done that.
Kath Austin was shocked by the amount of single-use plastic her family were going through and set out to change things. It took 18 months, but resulted in the development of a reusable beeswax food wrapping. 3 years later, BB Wraps is a successful business with the product being sold across the UK. Thank you very much for joining us today on Women Making Waves, Kath.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Now, when you left the school, did you imagine that you'd be in the position you're in today with a business like this?
When I left school? Oh, gosh, no. That was a while ago. In fact, when I left school, I had no real idea of what I wanted life to be like for me. I don't think anyone could ever expect a 16-year-old to know that when they leave school, you know, even knowing where you want to go to college or if at all. So no idea.
So what did you do for a living before you started BB Wraps?
Well, I did a number of different jobs before I fell into what became my career. So, you know, when I say a number of different jobs, anything from insurance clerk to pharmacy assistant to cattery hand, school photographer, pretty much did a massive range of things. And then I'd started working in events and putting on events, community events, realised that the fundraising sector did this a lot, and then went after a job in fundraising and stayed there for 15 years and really, really loved it.
How did you come up with the idea of reusable wraps? What made you do that?
Okay, so it was quite a lot of kind of things coming together. As often is the case, you find that there's kind of this synchronicity in life, isn't there? So I was working for a hospice called Arthur Rank in Cambridge as a fundraiser. I'd had my first daughter. I was on maternity leave with my second. There's just so much more stuff, isn't there? As soon as you have another human, there's just more stuff. There's more clothing, there's more gifts, there's more of everything. I couldn't believe how much plastic came with that stuff. Weirdly, at the same time, I'd started baking sourdough bread because you don't do that when you have a newborn baby, but I think I needed something for myself. So started baking this bread, realised very quickly, if you don't buy bread, it comes with no packaging. So how do you keep it fresh? I started conversations with other people. Someone suggested that, well, plastic's only 100 years old, so what did we do before that? And then I realised that we must have done something. I did a bit of research on Google. I found this artisanal community, global community of people making waxed fabric in their homes for food preservation. So I started doing that. I ripped up some bed sheets. I bought some beeswax from a local beekeeper and I started trying to make my own. Realised very quickly that just using beeswax isn't always enough for a good enough product because it can crack. and started experimenting with other ingredients. We've settled on rosin and jojoba oil that we add into the mix. That's the 18 months of kind of research, and then it just kind of was born.
And at what point did you think, okay, I've got this product, I want actually to put it into production and start selling it? Or was it just that there was lots of interest from your friends?
Yeah, there was definitely lots of interest from my friends. They all thought it was another one of Kath's crazy plans, because I've always got a project going on, like the sourdough or, you know, various other things, especially kitchen-based stuff. They loved it. They said, oh, you should sell this, because it's so easy to say that, isn't it, to someone else? And I thought, well, maybe I'll give it a try. Maybe I'll just sell it at a market and see how it does. We almost sold out that day. So I brought home £800 that I didn't start with, and thought, wow, that's amazing. I also decided to open an Etsy shop. I don't know if you've heard of Etsy, the like global community of crafters. And I had two orders in 24 hours that weren't from my mom. So clearly there were people looking for this product, but not finding it, especially in the UK. And so I started receiving orders for them. So I was having to make them on demand. Pretty much every evening of my life for that first year was spent in my kitchen making BB wraps for these orders. So yeah, that was the April 2017. And then things really started to take off after Christmas.
And was it scary giving up the day job?
Yeah, that was one of the hardest decisions I had to make, because I'd fallen into this world of fundraising. It matched all of my skills. I've got really good people skills. I'm terrible at anything analytic, but great with people. And I found it very hard to walk away from a job that I loved. How many people do you meet who really love their job? But I remember coming home from our holiday and David saying to me, you have to do it. It's a no-brainer. He says, you don't even earn that much anyway. Just do it. Which is so funny looking back now. But he said, yeah, just do it. I had his full support. I gave in my notice. It was really sad. But I think, you know, life's never static, is it? You have to move on. And this fell in my lap, and I thought, I have to do something with it.
Do you think that your previous experience gave you the edge from starting up your business, the experience that you'd had with people? You know, you say you're a people person, and fundraising as well, presumably?
Yes, definitely. I think understanding people, and I always say that I'm lucky that I am my own audience. I think a lot of the people who buy from us have a very similar kind of profile, if you like, as me. And so I understand who we're selling to, I think, I hope. And one of the things that I realized very early on is that the people that I was selling to perhaps aren't ardent eco-warriors. They want to do better, but they also don't want to buy something that's a bit boring. So right from the early stages, I knew that we wanted to do something that was beautiful and exciting at the same time. So perhaps, yes, understanding how to market and how to sell things, because essentially fundraising is just selling with an altruistic edge to it.
And how did you go about getting the product into the shops?
Absolute belligerence. The first person I asked if they would stock it said no, which is, it's good to get an early no. And then I simply asked and asked and asked. And actually one of the first people to stock our wraps was Jackie Sutton Adam, who owns the Cambridge Cheese Company. And she is a member of Transition Cambridge. We're a transition town. And she's really on board with the idea of using something other than single-use plastic. So I had her buy-in from kind of the eco level, but also on top of that, she understood that they would be an amazing accessory for people to use at home. They'd save on food waste. They'd preserve this amazing cheese much better. So it's great when you get someone who really believes in it and has a bit of a reputation behind them that you can kind of springboard onto the next person. And I guess that's how it happens. And over 3 years, we finally got to the kind of, you know, almost the pinnacle of my aspirations. And that was, we've just launched a range with Lakeland, which was awesome.
I've often wondered about the process of growing a business. It's quite interesting to understand it, because suddenly you need to employ help because, you know, it's getting too much for you. And then you need more help. And then you decide you need premises as well. Was that an organic thing, or did you have a carefully laid out plan?
Never a carefully laid out plan ever. In fact, one of the criticisms that most people have of me is that I tend to jump in with both feet and not really understand what the plan is, which is good, because we wouldn't be here if it wasn't for that attitude of jumping in. But now I realize that having a plan is probably a good idea. So we didn't have the big plan. We didn't have a business plan or a strategy in the beginning, but it was very clear that things were getting out of hand and I needed some help. And taking on an employee was just a massive step for me, because not only did I have some help, and that's great, and I could delegate, I suddenly became responsible for someone. And that is something that I did not fully understand the gravity of. So managing people is, you know, I've only done it a little before. And yeah, it's one of the hardest aspects of the job, just juggling all these other people as well as your own workload. But with that comes this amazing leverage and being able to see them run with something that you would have struggled with. So yes, Bebe was my first employee. So Bebe worked for Bebe in the first year. Yeah, so now we have about 16 or 17 people working for us at the moment, on and off. And at the moment, they're furloughed, but they will very soon come back, I hope.
And you were on Dragon's Den. What was that like?
Yeah, scary. Very scary. They don't pull their punches at all. In fact, the behind the scenes isn't at all relaxed, or, you know, people aren't kind of like, oh, don't worry, it's only a show. No, it's extremely serious when you're there, which I didn't fully anticipate. And it's a very long day as well. So I was in the green room for 11 hours beforehand. Oh, sorry, there's some kids just screaming out. So yeah, 11 hours in the green room, an hour and a half in the den being grilled. It was really intense, but I think what it gave me was the ability to understand that I can go into any situation like that and know I'll be okay. So yeah, it was a really good experience, although it was quite testing.
And Peter yeah. Jones uses the wraps, I believe.
Yes, that was a brilliant way to open. Literally, the first thing he said to me was, Kath, hi, I'm Peter. I know. And he said, I'm going to shock everyone now. I've got that wrap in my kitchen. So that was such a confidence boost for me to know that he was using them at home. And he said he loves them. They're an amazing product and well done. Ultimately, I don't think he really saw an investment opportunity, which I can understand, but his vouch for our product was just brilliant.
It's a great way to start. During this process, this is a very negative question, so I'm just warning you, have you ever felt like giving up? Have you ever felt like just going, I've had enough of this?
Yeah, like 5 times a day. I honestly can't stress this point enough. It's not a negative question at all. I think it's really positive to ask those questions, because this Instagram face that everybody has, people need to see through it. In the first year, I was still getting up in the middle of the night and feeding my daughter. And I remember I'd go to sleep and I'd just managed to get to sleep and then wake up. And as soon as I woke up, my head would start whirring. In fact, saying it now, I can still feel all the stress emotions. My head would start whirring, I'd start panicking, and you're at your most vulnerable there, aren't you? It's the middle of the night and you're tired. Why am I doing this? This is so silly. And there have been times along the way, lots of times, where I've thought this sacrifice, the hard work, the worry, the uncertainty of it all, is it really worth it? But I've seen so many things on the kind of life cycle of an entrepreneur, and it's like this. It's just up and down, roller coastering the whole time. And that can be all in one day. And it's absolutely like that. I guess if you're not used to uncertainty and you're not capable of coping with complete roller coaster of emotions, it perhaps isn't a good idea to try it. But there'll always be an up to the down. And that's the only thing I've learned, is just to hold on and it will pass.
And I see from your website, which I really like, by the way, I think it's a fun, lovely website.
Thank you. Yeah, we're big on colour, aren't we?
It's lovely. I see that you're really supportive of women in business. Do you think it's more difficult for women, or do you think they bring their own ideas and difference to the party and they make good entrepreneurs?
Well, of course, women make excellent entrepreneurs just as much as men do. I don't think that you can ever compare men with women and get a kind of like-for-like comparison. We've got completely different, all of us as individuals, completely different skill sets. So in that sense, there's no real competition. But I guess the barriers come from that, you know, just sexism in the workplace, that people's expectations of women, especially women who've gone away and had babies and come back, there's like an old school hangover that you're not perhaps up to scratch, or I don't know. The only thing that I've ever found as a woman, and especially a short one at 5'2", is that people expect less. But I'm so up for that challenge, because I think if people expect less and then you dazzle them with semi-average, you can only win. I really love the moment where you just kind of turn the tables and go, actually, I can do this. And they're pretty surprised.
And what advice would you have for anyone who's got a great idea and they want to start their own business or they're thinking about it? Based on what you went through, have you any great advice for them?
Yes, some good advice. Yes. A great idea is a great idea, and it will always be a great idea unless it becomes a great action. So don't just have a great idea and then say, oh yeah, I wish I'd done that. Why don't you just test it out? And there's a book called The Lean Startup. I can't remember who wrote it. That's terrible. But I think starting something cheaply and failing really fast is very good advice from that writer. So test it out really quickly. If it fails, move on. And if it gets some traction, and one of those lovely business phrases, keep going. And the other advice is to surround yourself with people who tell you the truth and who are helpful and honest and support you. Because one of the greatest things I did, which was kind of an accident, was I joined an incubator program in the first year for social ventures, and they literally held my hand and gave me a 101 on how to run a business, which was a very good grounding lesson. And one of the mentors is still one of my non-exec directors who helps me quite a lot. So it's good to have people around you who just know.
That is good advice. And especially, do not remortgage the house based on your idea.
No, do not do that. Actually, speaking of Dragon's Den, you see people go on there and they say, yes, I've invested £100,000 of my own money in this business. And you think, why would you do that if it's not making any money? One of the best things like that BBWraps ever did was it gave us, we've put money into it, but not a lot. We've had to put some in just over the years, but knowing that we couldn't put money in and we had to earn the money first to spend the money was really, really good. I'm so glad that we didn't have to put in money to, potentially lose it.
How do you fit in running the business and your family life?
Oh, every time someone asks me this question, I get emotional. Sorry. I'm always torn between my kids and my partner, although David works for BBWraps, so I'm always with him. But I'm always torn between the kids and the business. Like, there is no way to balance it. There's absolutely no way to do it. And I've heard women say, oh, you can have it all. You just can't. I think there are times when the kids win out and I will ditch BBWraps and say, no, you come first. That's fine. I will not go to that event because it's some assembly or something. But there are a lot of times when, I don't go to the school pickup when it's school and get the kids. So there is no way to balance it adequately. And coming to terms with that is hard.
And that's Kath Austin talking to Linda. So Linda, I found that interview with Kath Austin absolutely incredible. What really stuck out for me is that she went from making sourdough to beeswax wraps. I thought that was incredible how you can, how you can transcend from that. That not a lot of people would think about doing that, but she's quite a savvy lady, isn't she?
It's often the way though, isn't it? Because you start off doing one thing and that triggers another. So yeah, it's just one of these things, but kind of not surprising in a way. But what a great idea.
Yeah, it was a great idea. So what I also found really fantastic, and it was a great line in what Kath said, that behind every great idea, you need then a great action in any startup, don't you?
It's so true, isn't it? I took that as well from what she said. I thought another thing that she said that was really interesting was that if you do decide to go into business, don't remortgage the house. Well, it was me that said that, but don't chuck everything at it. Take it slow and steady and see how it goes. And I think that's a really good lesson, because I think a lot of people just get a bit overexcited sometimes when they're starting a business.
I know. It's It's a big step to do that. You're absolutely right. I never quite understood that. And the idea of being on a Dragon's Den as well, and seeing that one of the judges said to her that I actually use the beeswax at Wraps at Home. I thought that was quite extraordinary, because you don't really hear that on Dragon's Den. You just hear the new product. But she came away from that really quite uplifted, didn't she?
Yes, but I think she was also a bit surprised about how serious the whole thing was taken. But then I suppose there would be. There's a lot of money at stake for the people that are successful in Dragon's Den.
Yeah.
But I think just going on there publicises your product and does the job it's meant to do, to be quite honest.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right. I think that's true. And she sounds like she works very, very hard, even when her oldest was growing up and she was feeding in the middle of the night and she was worrying about her new business. It takes a lot of guts and, I suppose, insight, really, to go for that. And I love the way she feels that one of the most important things is to always surround yourself with people that are going to be honest to you.
Yes. Yes. No, I thought she was great. I thought she was really down to earth, really lovely. I really enjoyed chatting to her.
We'll be right back. Women Making Waves on Cambridge 105 Radio.
Patrice Lawrence feels we're living in a world where writers of colour are still underrepresented. Patrice writes stories that reflect families who don't have a voice or face in the world of books. Initially, Patrice's debut book, Orange Boy, faced resistance from publishers and their reluctance to present this new and different story. It was later shortlisted for the Costa Children's Book Award and won the bookseller YA Prize and Waterston's Prize for Older Children's Fiction. Patrice Lawrence speaks to Susie Thorpe.
Award-winning writer of stories for children and young people, Patrice Lawrence is charmed by London music and sci-fi. She loves reading stories that confound stereotypes and feels very strongly about the need to mirror the diverse range of lives and experiences she sees around her every day in her own writing. Hello, Patrice. When did you discover, Patrice, there were not enough representations of you in stories?
To be honest, I never, ever expected that I would be in a story. So I think for me to say, you know, did I ever expect to see myself represented? It's like, I don't know, saying, Patrice, do you want to be a strawberry? Because it was just so random and surreal that I should ever be there. I mean, I was born in the UK and I grew up in the 70s and 80s in Sussex. And a lot of the books I read were, I suppose, the classic books, you know, Secret Garden, Heidi, Wind in the Willows, Little Women, all of those type of books. And there were never anybody that looked like me. And also, I sort of grew up in a family where my stepdad's Italian, my mum's Trinidadian, you know, they weren't married. Everything about us was different. So for me, it was an absolute impossibility. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I think the first time I thought that we could actually be in books, as in UK people of colour, as opposed to sort of American, when I was 32. And I just had a baby. It was 2 weeks old and it was December. And I turned on the TV and it was the BBC adaptation of Mallory Blackman's Pickup Boy. And I've been writing for a long time, but never put people of colour in stories because I just thought, we're just not in stories, not in on writing, not on a page. And then suddenly it's like, oh my goodness, we could be. And it's just like this door opened for me.
Yeah. The idea that you discover something like this at the age of 32, Patrice, is absolutely heartbreaking because you, me, we should all be reading books reflecting all of society. It's a loss to all of us, really.
I mean, absolutely. I think, you know, we can find our world through books so we can find ourselves, but also others. And it helps us develop our empathy, our knowledge, our care, you know, our kindness. And I think one of the things, I grew up in sort of West Sussex, and the secondary school I went to, there was probably less than 10 of us out of 1,700 who weren't white. And I had a good time at school. I have good friends. I was quite academic. But I remember, you know, the only thing we learned about people of African descent was that we were enslaved. So nothing about how we fought abolition or nothing at all. And I remember our headmaster doing an assembly about Jesse Owens, the sprinter. And it's the first time I'd heard of him. And I just sat there in the middle of this assembly with all these sort of white students around me, feeling so proud, thinking that actually we did do things, we did achieve. So it's how you sort of, your identity is seen to be powerful to others is important too. And I think we can do that in books by making all different people heroes and heroines.
Mm. You were brought up in a mixed race family. How important is it to recognise families? I mean, all family units, when trying to connect people to read?
For me, that's absolutely essential. And when I do school talks, I talk about the fact that all the things that made me feel different and to some degree made me feel lesser are all the things that made me a better writer. So I've never lived in a family where we're all the same colour. So the first family I lived in was a foster family because my mum was the only one of her siblings, her family, who came to England. So she was the second youngest of 12, and she came from Trinidad just to train to be a nurse, and then met my biological father, who had come from Guyana. They're brought up in Barbados, and trained to be a nurse. And they were both sort of early 20s, Brighton 60s parties, and suddenly my mum is pregnant. And it was just also just pre the Abortion Act. So I think my dad wanted her to sort of terminate the pregnancy and she didn't want to. So the choices were really for me to be adopted, as obviously quite a lot of people my age were if their parents weren't married. But I was privately fostered from the age of 4 months to 4 years with a family in Brighton who were absolutely lovely, sort of white working class family, really cared for me and nurtured me. And then I went back to live with my mum, who had met my Italian stepdad then. So, and then I've got two brothers from there. And when I sort of write my stories, I always write about families, quite often where there might be a family, where there might be a bereavement or a single parent family, or families with a new book where one character's mum marries the other character's dad. And when I talk in schools, it's so relatable to young people, absolutely. And to see that families are all shapes and all colours and have their place in books.
You're brilliant at writing from different perspectives, Patrice. Do you think men have this ability too?
I don't know. I think it's interesting with Orange Boy. I've got a really brutal writing group. And in the first few drafts of it, they say, like, no, Marlon, that is not a boy. That's just you, Patrice, with a boy's name. And it's like, oh, you know, like he's wearing trousers. And, you know, and it's like, no, he just sounds like you. So I actually had to do a lot of research. And two things actually worked for me. One was just the basic thing of asking, particularly my writers group who had teenage sons and other friends who had teenage sons, really just observe them, think if it sounded real. And secondly was I changed the story from third person to first person, because originally it was a really close, you know, close point of view third person. But by actually changing to first person, I could see through Marlon's eyes. I could think how he would sit on the bus. I could think how he would see how people project things onto him. I could really visualise and get under his skin. But it did take a lot of research, because obviously I'm writing not just from a different gender, but from a different age and, you know, having not grown up in London. So it did take a lot of research. But I'm just lucky that I know a lot of people are willing to answer quite intimate questions about what it is. For Marlon, it's also because I'm writing about a young black boy who gets involved in crime. The temptation is for people to read it as stereotypes or to read it as an archetype. And so it was really important for me to make him very much an individual. So that's why he's, you know, geeky and sci-fi, and he sort of clings to the music, you know, that is that inherited from his dad. Whereas Bailey in Indigo Donut, I really kind of wanted a really kind boy who's really comfortable with his kindness, I think. So I think I was writing a bit of an archetype there, but, you know.
Besides reading your books, what other ways are you trying to reach people to find your books?
I think that's one of the joys of school visits and going into secondary schools, which I do quite a lot. I was lucky enough this year to be part of the Hay Festival Scribblers Tour. So they work with five universities in Wales, and schools can elect to come, bring in usually year 8, 9 or 10 students, the ones who wouldn't normally go to university. And they choose four writers, two middle grade next year, two young adult writers. So this year it's me and Brian Conahan, both who kind of grew up working class environments. So we could talk about our journey, about how, you know, someone like me who would never, ever dream that their mum would go into Waterstones and say, you know, that's my daughter, you know, and about everything that told me that I couldn't be a writer, made me a writer. I also have a secret weapon, which is my teenage diary from when I was 13. So that is incredibly relatable, even though they cringe a lot on my behalf. And I also talk, when I've done other sort of workshops, I talk about different types of stories. For instance, how Pixar uses fear and things like Toy Story and Up to create, you know, our sympathy for characters. I talk about Korean dramas, which have fantastic arcs in their episodes. And also spoken word poetry, how there's some brilliant young spoken word poets who record on video and talk about things that are incredibly relatable to lots of young people. So there are kind of different ways that we can think about how words and stories can be used.
You said that music is really important in your books, and sci-fi as well. How do you use it in your books, Patrice?
Yes, sci-fi was more in the first book in Orange Boy, mainly because it was sort of an accident in that I wrote the original paragraphs at a crime writing course just from a writing prompt, and I had no idea that it was going to be a book. And I'd chosen Marlon's name simply because that was the name of a boy in my daughter's class in primary school. And then when I started writing the book, I was thinking, oh my gosh, you know, I am writing a black boy that's getting involved in crime. I want to explore that because there are a lot of knife crime in Hackney where I live, but I can't make this boy a stereotype. So all I thought was, like, how would he get his name? Well, Marlon Brando was Superman's dad in the films when I was a kid. So what if his dad was really into sci-fi? And my biological dad was really into Isaac Asimov and Star Trek. So I kind of bought that over. And I loved The Matrix, well, the first one, the other two of it. So all of those things. And music, I think, is something that really combined us. You know, that sense of when you go to sort of live music and everybody's singing the same chorus. So I think music, also for music for me, is mood as well. So I use a lot of that to sort of shape mood and bring people together.
All of what you've written so far really, really matters to you. And it's not just becoming an author, but it's all about changing perceptions as well.
Oh, absolutely. And you can really see the difference it makes, you know, when I've had sort of young people and sometimes adults well who have experienced some of the issues that I talk about in the books. And I think one of the things I talk about when I do school visits is in my biological father who died when I was in my 20s and he was in his 40s. And he'd had a breakdown. He'd been in prison for a month for forging a check. But because he's a nurse, obviously he couldn't work, and then he couldn't rent his property and became sort of street homeless in Brighton, and he died in a house fire in a squat. And I sort of talk about this, and I talk about it because I say that there's quite a lot of bereavement and loss in the books as well. But I know that sometimes when you're holding things inside, it's really hard to talk about bereavement and loss to other people because you're dealing with your own feelings and then you have to deal with somebody else's reactions. But actually, you can find yourselves in books. So for me, it feels a really big responsibility about what I put in books and what young people see there and how they see themselves. Because even though they're contemporary books and the issues that I deal with are quite tough, I also want there to be hope, because I just think young people are incredibly strong and resilient as well.
It's really interesting what you say about responsibility. And I suppose in light of what we're going through right now with lockdown and reading about fake news too, you try to focus your novels on true representation of society.
I suppose, but I think all books can be in a sense. And I suppose I don't set out that way. I start off with characters. But I say to young people, I'm a bit like Hulk, that I'm permanently angry. So when I wrote Indigo Donut, I had no idea what I was going to write because I had the 2-book deal. But it was also at a time when foster children, if they were living with their foster carers, were supposed to leave the family when they were 18. And I remember thinking my own daughter was like 15 or 16, really responsible. You know, when she's 18, it'll be a time for celebration, not saying, now leave the house. And I think that made me incredibly angry. So when I was writing about somebody who's in foster care, I felt it really important for me to represent what her truth was, but also to sort of feeding some messages about what it's like to be in that situation. And I've been really lucky that I have had really good responses for young people who are care experienced, who have actually seen themselves in a book or a version of themselves. So I think, yes, I think that is incredible great responsibility. Mm. I mean, the other thing I suppose I remember is when those sort of days before the internet at school, we used to have this little book club. So they used to give you these little brochures with the books in it, and you'd circle it and take it back to your family and get your £2.99 and then buy the book. And one of the books we had was Rumour Godden's The Didikoi, which was the book that BBC TV series Kizzy was based on. And it was about a young gypsy heritage woman who left a community and went to mainstream school where she got bullied. And it was, in a sense, the first book I read that was about racism. And the first book, I think, where I thought, oh, these things happen to other people. There's a word for it. And you can put these things in books. So hopefully also, you know, these books are an inspiration for other people who feel that they don't see themselves, but they can put themselves in books as well.
How do you readdress realism and portray both real endings with real happy endings as well?
Yeah, I suppose so. But I do want, I think, hope. So at the end, you know, I think it would be false to give Marlon, for instance, an automatic happy ending in Orange Boy, because there are consequences, and I think that's another thing for books for young adult, there are consequences. But also I think, want there to be moments of, you know, families come together, friendships that are strengthened, relationships that are strengthened as well. So I do want those, you know, some that hope and happiness there, but actually there are consequences. And quite often for the characters in my books, they're consequences of what older generations have done as well. Because I think, you know, there's a lot of blaming young people for things, but actually we set up the internet and, you know, dodgy porn on the internet.
Like all your books, Orange Boy has had fabulous reviews, including comments like wonderful, believable characters, it's gripping. What has the response been from the younger generation?
I think what was interesting is, I mean, I had no idea how publishing works because I was always working full time. So for me, it was kind of what I was doing on the side was writing and sort of bringing up my daughter. So I sort of didn't focus on it as much as I could have. So what was interesting was going to festivals and people saying that, you know, quite often boys don't read. I get a lot of boys buying Orange Boy and signing it and talking about, you know, their own writing. I did a tour in Italy in November for my Italian publishers, and they had given copies of the book in Italian to some schools. So we had lots of conversations about, you know, whether London is really that dangerous, about why Marlon does what he does, and also sort of conversations about what the difference is around if you're a black boy or a white boy, your engagement with the police, even if you're, you know, not a criminal. So that's had some really sort of interesting conversations. And my, I suppose my fear was that it has been described occasionally as a book about gangs, which it really is not. You know, I think that's quite lazy. It's a book about families and family drama and a boy who's one of life's lovely people who gets drawn into something that he doesn't want to, but actually suddenly finds himself performing this other type of masculinity that actually feels quite liberating and powerful. So there's lots of other, so, you know, lots of themes to talk about, as well as obviously The Matrix and Star Trek.
You began to realise at age 32, while bringing up a young child, that you couldn't see yourself being represented in novels, TVs and films. What was it like writing with a young baby at the start of your career?
I think that was actually a fundamental difference, really. It's I never expected to see me, but also, you know, I grew up in a really white area, so it was just kind of my norm. When I moved to London, and my daughter is, you know, is a proper Londoner, I presume that there'd be lots of books, picture books especially, that have mixed race families, because we're not that rare. Then I'd look, and there'd be nothing. And I was walking down the South Bank once and saw a book by, I think Helen Stevens, called What About Me, a picture book, and it's got this on the cover, sort of a drawing of a girl called Katie, this kind of big brown face, curly hair. And my 9-month-old baby used to kiss that picture because she thought it was me. And it just made me think that if even a baby can see representation, what the hell am I doing? You know, with writing white characters. But it still took me a really long time to do it. And I think that's really part of it also is, I think, you know, I'm the first of my generation to be born in the UK. I sort of grew up in West Sussex, and I had no idea how to represent me, because I think a lot of the other black characters that I saw were often in areas that were predominantly black. So there'd be like the soap opera, I think Empire Road, that came on, I think, in the 70s and 80s. And I kind of didn't grow up in those communities either. So it's trying to work out, who am I and what do I write about that didn't seem such a stereotype? So, you know, I think perhaps it's not coincidence that I had to live in London for many, many years before those books got written and published.
Apart from starting to become an author at this stage, what were you working on as well besides this?
I mean, when I came to London, I came as a mature student to go to Goldsmiths and did a degree in English and History of Art when I was sort of 27. And I thought, there's no way in hell am I going back to Haywood Heath, even though I had a sort of house there, which I sort of eventually sold. And it was at a time when it was easier to get jobs. So I started working in a voluntary sector, which I didn't even know existed. So one of the first jobs was working as an advocate for a new project in Newham that was supporting African and Asian parents that are going through child protection. So I've done quite a lot of work with organisations, particularly around social justice and equality. So I've worked with organisations that work with prisoners and families of prisoners, with young people in care. So it have always been those type of jobs. And I think what that's taught me is that there are so many stories out there, and that the stories and the rhetoric, when we go back to fake news, you know, the idea that prisons are a holiday camp, oh, they are so not. Mm. And all those other alternative stories and voices that don't get heard and stories that don't get heard are still swirling around us. And I think a lot of those have ended up in my books.
What would you advise to a younger generation if they are interested in writing right now?
I think I always start off saying, even something really basic, that actually to be a writer, you don't need to spell. That's what technology is there for. That to be a writer, you don't have to put 400 adjectives before a noun, because that's not your voice. That you can tell stories in so many different ways. You can make lists, you can do mind maps, you can draw, you can do diaries, you can record to audio. I might give them a name of some poets that they could look up on YouTube or Vimeo. I'll just talk to them also about, just look at the stories in films, look at how Black Panther is like your perfect three-act structure, you know, look at the series that you watch, how do they tell stories? Stories emerge in lots of different ways. Try and write something. It doesn't matter, it doesn't have to be every day, you don't have to finish it, but just primarily think of your own voice. The writing that you have to do to pass an exam isn't necessarily your voice. You have your own unique voice, and think about how you can use that to tell stories.
I suppose I'd like to talk about criticism, really. How would you teach young writers to take criticism when beginning to write without putting them off, I suppose?
I think for me it's the slight opposite. I think what was interesting was that last year I was a judge for the BBC Young Writers Award. So it's the one that's sort of after the 500 words. So it's from, I think, 14 to 18 are the age category. And as a judge, you were sent, I think it was 50 pieces that were up to 1,000 words. And you had to choose your top 15 or something like that. And what was, I suppose, upsetting was some of them, many of them are really, really similar because of the way creative writing is taught in schools. So to pass that, you know, you have to have your adjectives, preferably some of them taken from a thesaurus. You know, it's all interchangeable. And I think the ones that we like particularly were the ones where actually young people did use their own voice and didn't necessarily have those adjectives, but told a story that sounded like them and something that they really cared about. So I think it's actually the way that we can enable young people to say, this is how you write to pass an exam, but this is how you tell a story that's you. And I think, you know, from now, from primary school, where they're being told, you know, these are the elements of a sentence, to try and get people out of that is really hard.
OK, Patrice, so what is it like when you switch off? How do you switch off? Is there something that really gives you a chance to remove yourself from the world of writing?
That's the issue, though, I can't. And it's not, honestly, it's not even writing. And one of the things I talk about with young people is say, what, you know, why do you write or why are you a writer? It's like, there are so many stories in my head all the time. And every time I go out and you hear a snippet of conversation, that's like another story. So I was kind of saying to them that once I was on a train, it was quite early in the morning because I was going, I had to get something like a 7:24 a.m. train to Sheffield. So I was getting the local overground, sort of standing there because it was still blooming crowded. And this argument broke out between this woman who was sitting down and this guy who was standing up. And I think the guy's son had put a crisp packet on the chair or something. The woman took umbrance, quite rightly, but they were just behaving like toddlers, shouting abuse at each other, like, you're ugly, you're old. And I mean, I'm just thinking, firstly, it's like, how much sugar did you have in your Weetabix? Because I can barely yawn at this time of morning, let alone argument. But secondly, I'm just thinking, hey, what if they know each other? You know, what if, why we're distracted looking at them, there's like aliens searching through our bags for some hidden technology. So it's like everything is always a story. So it's really hard to switch off. So my sort of thing at the moment was, I'm always way behind the curve. So I've just watched all of Killing Eve. That killed me for a moment. So I just need to find sort of all-inclusive, compulsive things to watch that will help me switch off for a while. Because other than that, it's like, oh my gosh, there's another story.
Thank you. That was Susie Thorpe talking to Patrice Lawrence. See, that was a really interesting interview. It must have been really, really good speaking to her.
Yeah, you're right. It was really good to be able to talk with Patrice because she was very honest. A lot of the time in that interview, as you would have heard, she said she's angry that she doesn't see a lot of representation of people of colour in books and children's books and younger books. So it's her mission, it's her life to be able to do this. And I asked her, obviously in the interview as well, if she has time to switch off, and we just heard this. She said, no, she never switches off. This is what she loves doing. So it's an incredible thing, really, to have that focus just by seeing there was not a lot of representation of herself in stories, in films and TV, that she felt she had to do it for the sake of her daughter and for people as well, just representing them.
I do think, Susie, that things are getting a lot better, because you only have to look at television adverts to notice that the representation of different races, it's much, much better than it used to be.
Absolutely, it is. I think it's got a bit to go though, Linda, but you're absolutely right.
Oh yeah, it has a bit to go, but yeah. I think we're getting there. We're on the right track.
And it was great to have her talking with us on Women.
Yeah, she sounded lovely.
It was really nice.
Screen falling off the door hanging off the hinges. My feet are still sore, my back's on the fringes. We tore up the walls, we slept on couches. We lifted this house, we lifted this house. Firecrackers in the east, my car parks out. Your hands on my cheeks, your shoulder in my mouth. I was up against the wall on the west mezzanine. We rattle this town, we rattle this scene. Oh, do you know this house is falling apart? Can I say
we have time for in this edition of Women Making Waves. We'd like to thank our guests, Kath Austin and Patrice Lawrence. If you know of a woman who is making waves, we'd like to speak to her.
You can contact us via social media on Twitter and Facebook at WomenMW or on Instagram at Women Making Waves Radio. You can also find our podcasts on Cambridge105radio.co.uk or you can visit our website womenmakingwaves.co.uk where you can hear all of our interviews.
Women Making Waves is a Jibber Jabber production.